Welcome to Regulatory Ramblings. I'm your host, Jay Shandasani. Before we begin today's conversation, please subscribe to hkufintech.com to stay abreast of the latest Regulatory Ramblings podcasts, as well as other activities in the fintech community at HKU. Our podcast is a joint production of the RegTech Lab, HKU Standard Chartered Fintech Academy, and the HKU edX Professional Certificate in Fintech. And our guest today is an old friend of mine. She's one of the more knowledgeable people in the field of anti-money laundering, at least in Asia Pacific. Wei Dong is the Association of Certified Anti-Money Laundering Specialists, or better known as ACAMS, Global Head of New Ventures and their Senior Asia Pacific Leader. She joins us for a discussion on AML, financial crime compliance, as well as the current state of sanctions, particularly those on Russia, and how they might affect unsuspecting businesses in Asia. And with that, Wei, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It has been a long time, and I'm really glad to have this opportunity to have a conversation and catch up on what's been happening.
ACAM started not long before 9/11, and so tell us about
the journey,
what ACAMS does, the growth it's seen in the two decades' existence, particularly in China and APAC, and its influence on the profession, the value it adds.
Sure.
And what the future holds.
So, as you know, actually ACAMS was formed in January 2001, and 9/11 did make a meaningful, motivation into the development of this industry. If it weren't for the pandemic, actually, we would have actually touted more about the fact that January 2021 was a celebratory period in ACAMS history at the 20th anniversary. And if you think about what we're here to do, I mean, our aspirational mission is to end financial crime, right? And how do we do that? We started off in the first 20 years really focused on community building, capacity building, knowledge sharing, frankly, creating a standard. I mean, we are the industry standard-setting body in the world of financial crime compliance.
A lot of places they won't look at your CV without it.
Exactly.
You have to have it to get in the door.
Well, it's like the equivalent. I remember, you think about it, when I started this for ACAMS in 2008 for Asia Pacific, and I'll talk a little bit about my journey there. But it's really about recognizing, the equivalent of, if you're an accountant, you get your CPA. If you're an asset manager, an investment manager, you get CFA. Well, if you're in financial crime compliance, you're going to need your certified anti-money laundering specialist, or your CAMS. And I think this is in recognition that, first and foremost, the compliance function is a cost center, right? So if you think about what industry need to commit in terms of resources, you have to justify that spend, right? And so the latest focus now is all about effectiveness, right? It's all about demonstrating efficiency. And so I'm sure our conversation will go down that path. But in the last 20 years, I think about what we've done, which is capacity building, training, capacity building, and so on and so forth. But it's really about creating a standard. So why is this an important sort of a background to what I actually do now? I mean, I spent, the first, 12 to 13 years doing that, building that awareness and the knowledge base in the Asia Pacific community. But it also reflects the fact that in 2012, one of the most meaningful development, I mean, when we work in this space, we really need to think about what are the drivers, right? And the top of what I call the food chain is going to be the Financial Action Task Force or the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision or the Wolf's Work Group, or Egmont and so on and so forth. And also, key financial centers, right? Regulatory guidance that come from the U.S. or the U.K., Europe, and of course, Hong Kong, Singapore being the world's third and fourth largest financial center. You have to kind of pay attention to what those regulators are asking you to do. And so coming back to the FATF, in 2012, the FATF revised the recommendation. Prior to that, it was like 40 special recommendation plus the 9 related to terrorist financing. And in 2012, they basically brought it all together under the 40 recommendation. But what's really meaningful in that development is that in 2013, the FATF revised the mutual valuation methodology to go beyond technical compliance to effectiveness compliance. So technical compliance, have you complied with our 40 recommendation? What have you implemented? But effectiveness compliance based on 11 immediate outcome had to do with the fact that we now want you to demonstrate that you're actually enforcing it, that you're implementing this. And why is this important to what ACAMS had to do? So around the same period, we were also asking ourselves a question. Well, there's this emphasis on effectiveness. What is ACAMS' role in this sort of evolutionary approach to, AML compliance? So we asked ourselves, well, if you are talking about effectiveness, what can we do uniquely? So this is why it reflects my role in New Ventures, because we basically got the industry and public, the subject matter from both the industry and as well as the public sector, government, to give us insight on what it takes to create a global methodology in risk assessment, right? Now, that word risk assessment and risk has been thrown around a lot, but what we, ACAMS, is uniquely positioned to do is basically bring together two what I call sort of opposite ends of the spectrum. On the one hand, you have the regulated entity that says you're asking too much, you're compliancing me out of business. On the other hand, you have the regulator that says you're not doing enough, I can't see the benefits of what you're doing, right? So by creating a standard, it creates that bridge. It brings everyone closer together to answer this question: how do I know that with my limited resources, I am effectively allocating those limited resources to identify that risk? And it's just not for the industry. It's also for the regulators themselves. There are, existing regulators, but new regulators come online. They now have to implement IO3, which is risk-based supervision. So the question is, what does risk-based supervision look like? It's not a zero failure regime, because zero risk means zero business.
Great.
Right?
Long said.
Right.
Yeah.
So I think that what that does is that it leads us to think, okay, what is that global methodology look like? And what is that standard look like? And so I'd say that, almost 10 years into our formation, we started looking at the next level of standardization. So if you think about CAMS, that's the standardization effort in training education. Well, risk assessment is our next effort in standardization, right? Trying to bring all the key stakeholders together, not only within a specific jurisdiction, but also globally, to saying, how do we find the risk? Where is that risk? And where am I going to spend my limited resources to actually not only identify, but mitigate that risk, right? So I think that's the 20-year journey to date. And I've been asked to take on, the next phase of standardization, which is why I have this global ventures.
You're such a go-getter. You're always on the go. Very, very hard woman to pin down. So thank you so much for coming on. It's had a lot of influence on the industry.
Mm-hmm. Oh, just so you know, in case no one knows this, one of the most pride and joy in terms of ACAMS is the MoneyKnight.com. Do you know that was launched in the same period as the FATF was established with the G7 country, 1989?
I did not know that.
Yes, no. We have been around that long.
That long. Yeah. So, it was interesting you say that, because the revision of the 40 recommendations came at an interesting time, because I've heard people from the HKMA, once they've left, tell me, getting a good score on a mutual evaluation or getting a good overall compliance score as a jurisdiction has nothing to do with the amount of illegal funds sloshing around in your system. It's all about how good you are at, a certain form of compliance, a namesake form of compliance. So it's interesting to hear about your risk methodology, because I understand it seeks to go beyond just slipshod, commonplace, perfunctory. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Compliance. Yes. And the growth you've seen in China, mm-hmm. The growth you've seen in China and the chapters on the mainland, what are your impressions of that? I know for much of the last decade, that was your focus.
Mm-hmm. Well, in fact, actually, China being admitted as a full FATF member in July of 2007 was one of the key drivers in sort of ACAMS as a global membership body. Back then, it was around 8,000 or 9,000 members saying, okay, we need to do something about Asia, right? When you think about it, at that, still true today, although the positions have flipped, but the world's second and third largest economy, Japan and China, is in Asia. The world's three most populous nation, India, China, and of course, Indonesia, is also located here. And then, of course, as I mentioned, Hong Kong, Singapore being the world's third and fourth largest financial center outside of New York and London. So that was the question. So they said, okay, you just go figure it out, right? So that's what is it. You got to figure it out. You got to tell us what we need to do and stuff. And so to your point about the development, I mean, I think one of the most meaningful development in China was its mutual valuation in 2018. You know, and I think China's been working very hard at the technical compliance thing piece of it. I think the effective compliance is a challenge, not just for China, but actually for the Asia-Pacific region. Even Hong Kong, when they had their mutual valuation in the same year as China, you know, their effectiveness, especially like with DNFVP, designated non-financial business preference, in order to demonstrate effectiveness in any of these immediate outcome, you have to have at least 3 years worth of data. And Hong Kong's DNFVP legislation only went in checked in March of 2018, and then they had the mutual valuation in November 2018. So I think what this sort of leads us all to think about is, you know, one of the most, I mean, it's not just effectiveness from the perspective of those that are being regulated or being regulated, but FATF asked themselves too this question of how are they being effective. So there's a report that was published earlier this year that looked at, and I'm just going to refer to some data. I think it was something like April of this year, 76 countries have now satisfactorily implemented the 40 recommendation. It's a significant improvement from 2012 when there was only 36%. However, and there's the big however, the effectiveness piece is the big challenge. And in fact, this is going to be the key driver behind the FATF's, you know, fifth round mutual valuation, which is expected to start in 2025. And it's going to be a shorter cycle. I mean, this last cycle, the fourth round, was actually 10 plus years. I think it got pushed out a little bit more because of the pandemic. But it's all going to be effectiveness, right? And I think it's a very good question. Because to your point, is it just compliance? You said you've heard of folks that have, you know, left the regular to roll and say, well, it's all about ticking the box. But I think the emphasis on effectiveness, and what does that mean? What are your, you know, KPIs? What are your metrics? What are you trying to measure?
I don't want to point fingers, but there are jurisdictions that, you know, have a long way to go and they're getting good scores.
There is a delicate balance, I think, the FATF, because at the end of the day, you want to bring everyone into your ecosystem. Right. I mean, I have this conversation with one of the former deputy, you know, governors of the Bank of Malaysia years ago. He said, I really think that and part of this, the whole concept, the whole, you know, issue of financial inclusion is particularly critical to the Asia Pacific.
Yeah.
Right. But especially to our region, because we have a lot of developing economies.
And a lot of unbanked.
Right. And my view is, you know, people are going to get their financial services somewhere. So if you don't bring them into the system, they're just going to go underground.
Correct.
Right? Would it surprise you? And part of my research, I did a paper on financial inclusion published about years ago. But would it surprise you to find out that in the United States, according to a research by the U.S. Post Office, because it's how they were positioning themselves to get into sort of remittance, is saying one out of every four households in the United States actually don't have access to a bank account.
Given that it's the U.S., that's staggering. Yeah.
Yes, right. That's surprising. I mean, it's the world's largest economy. How can it be? But it does highlight the fact that it's, you know, money laundering prevention helps you identify these money flows. Right. And I think it does matter quite a bit. I think it's just a broader statement. I think social change, really. And that's been sort of my mission. Right. How money isn't just money. How you earn that money does really matter. I mean, you think in the context of, you know, we lose track of the fact that, oh, this is compliance. I have to do this and do that. But actually, you step back. What are the drivers behind the focus on money laundering prevention? Right. Money laundering is not a victimless crime. If you think about the predicate crimes that underlie it, for example, you know, if you look at statistics on law enforcement, over anywhere from any jurisdiction, over 95 to 97% of all crimes committed is profit-driven. So the very social ills that we don't want in our neighborhood, right, they continue to proliferate as long as they can enjoy the proceeds of crime. Actually, prison is just the cost of doing business.
Sometimes not even that far. We had Everett Stern on recently, and I was telling him, his point was, and this has been long known, that organized crime and terrorists are using counterfeit goods, contraband, to finance their activities. Okay, that's been known for over 20 years. But the other thing was that what they're finding is for the people don't see the national security, the money laundering aspect of it. They think of it as just an IP infraction. Right. And what they're those guilty of such offenses are like the penalties. The money is as good as drugs, and the penalties are a lot less. Mm.
Yeah.
So, you know, there is that.
But I mean, this sort of lends to our effort in the last, you know, almost 10 years in really working with law enforcement, right? To getting law enforcement to think that, you know, catching the perpetrator isn't enough. It's actually follow the money. It's the really critical piece, right? And we're really proud of that collaboration we've had with law enforcement. I think there's a guide that was recently published early this year where, you know, it was the HSI and ACAMS produced this sort of red flags from transactions and so on. So I think I really recommend everyone to take a look at it. But yes, I mean, you know, and I really think we're just at the start of the journey.
Depends on where that journey begins and what the antecedents and the catalysts are. Here's what I'm getting at. I wanted to ask you about what you see as the future of AML and financial crime compliance and sanctions in terms of employment prospects. People say sanctions roles are growing. FCC roles are growing. But this is coming against the backdrop of rising compliance costs. People saying, do we need this much headcount? People are talking about machine learning, AI. The day will come where maybe substantive knowledge of AML and financial crime won't matter as much. You can put a data scientist as the head of your AML team because it's about detection of, you know, sorting data, detection of patterns. What do you think? I mean, are you going to see unemployment in the compliance profession because of tech?
Look, we're right now in the sort of a global trend of sort of some sort of correction, right? Inflation, all that. But that said, you know, I look at the fact that, frankly, 2008, I was asked to build this community, and 2008 was one of our worst times in the world, right? We were on the precipice of collapse, really, as a global financial system, and yet I was able to, you know, frankly, effectively have this conversation, even though the majority of the conversation was, you know, we really don't have time to focus. AML is a luxury we don't have. We just focus on fraud kind of thing. So that's been an extraordinary development. So what I see happening in the employability factor is evolving from knowledge to the blending of technology and knowledge, right? So it's not going to be an AML specialist anymore. Actually, 5 years ago, I started saying this. AML specialist is not enough. You now need to be an AML technologist. This conversation, this question you have about whether, you know, technology would take over, I mean, it was the same thing like, you know, 20 years ago when banks started buying transaction monitoring systems and letting the IT make the decision, which is foolish, and I won't mention the bank, but there was a global bank that spent $50 million on a system built by IT and did not understand and ended up after 5 years of attempted rollout, they probably scrapped the whole thing and started all over. Because at the time, I talked to the chairperson, asking them who made the decision. They said, oh, IT. But so.
But AI was very young then.
Well, yes, but here's the thing. The use of AI, and I asked this question, I mean, if I can go through the themes we covered. We just had our 13th annual Hong Kong Symposium last week, our second in-person event. That was great. The question of AI, the use of AI machine learning, it's great in a number of businesses and anything you want to use to drive business. The key issue is that when you're doing AML compliance, the business and your internal key stakeholder isn't the only one. It's actually your primary key stakeholder, your regulator. The challenge with machine learning and AI is, by its very definition, AI, it learns. And so it's constantly getting better. But the problem is you now have the regulator comes in and say, okay, I saw that result. Can you repeat it? Can you explain it? Why did it do what it did? And that's where the people role won't go away, right? Because you now, no technology is accepted unless you can explain to the regulator.
Well, that is your ultimate constituent. You have to deliver the goods to them. And the counter argument, to be fair, because there are arguments being made on both sides. Mm. The counter argument is algorithms work until they don't. Mm-hmm. And the day an illicit transaction slips through the net, say an Iran sanctions violation, the hammer comes down. And then it's an awkward conversation to have with regulators because they'll say, you were too greedy, you were too penny-pinching, you went too far in the direction of automation to save money.
The human intervention piece is going to be necessary because to your point, there is not unlimited resources. The compliance budget, I think, in some, depending on the institution, but the large global banks, I might say, have peaked, right? Yeah. So the question is, I can't keep increasing it. And fundamentally, you know, if you're sitting on the board, you're going to ask, well, what am I getting for? What's the bang for my buck?
Yeah. Right? Who are these people in a fundamentally oversight role making not insubstantial amounts, mm-hmm. obviously not as much as the traders and the bankers? So there is that gripe amongst the executives. And at least with the tax department, I can quantify how much money they save me. So I know what their value is in a sense.
Well, so this to me, I wasn't talking as much about the you know, in people's individual salary. I was actually thinking more about, you've implemented this program. It comes back to my beginning comment. How do you demonstrate it's effective? I'm spending money on this compliance program. And so it really comes back down to this question of, how are your risk is assessing your risk? How do you understand your risk appetite? And how you demonstrate that you're confident that your risk profile in its evolutionary approach, which is necessary because business are dynamic, that you are catching up with it, right? And they keep an eye on it. So I think I'm on a mission now, right? Last couple of years, but this has like been really my focus. The mission is, in fact, to get financial institutions to think. Everyone keeps saying, oh, data, data, data. But actually, the focus on data is a mistake. It's not compliance.
As opposed to the modalities of crime.
Well, no, I mean, the focus on data, using data to help you identify your risk appetite and all that stuff, it is. But when you're looking at a holistic effectiveness question about your compliance program, it's all about governance and it's all about controls, right? Because only through that angle. And so you have to look at where is the fundamental risk that is entering my financial institution. People keep thinking about, is the customer? Yes, but not really, right? You're not building your entire AML program based on like a customer. You're building your AML program trying to mitigate the most fundamental risk. And where's that risk coming from? It's through your products, your service, the delivery channels of those products. And how you're providing those services. I mean, it's like any business, right? You launch a business, you have certain target customers, and you build your products accordingly. Well, financial services products do the same, except that you need to understand what the inherent risks that engender or attract bad actors to commit money laundering, right? And so then when you identify what are those inherent risks, you put in your recommended controls, and that's the big issue also. Financial institutions implement these controls, and yet when the regulators say, why did you do that? It's very difficult for them to succinctly and authoritatively point to sources and say, this is why I did what I did. Right? And this is where my mission on behalf of ACAMS come into play, because I want to be able to help us to the adoption of the standard that say, okay, let's all agree on the inherent risks. We may call our product names differently, but they offer the same service. Let's identify the inherent risks, so create that baseline. Here are the recommended controls that can be pointed to, you know, to authoritative sources. And then now everybody's talking the same language. And say, okay, I do that. Oh, I see where my gaps are, right?
Then you can articulate the rationale for
exactly. So back to the spending thing, right? Because if you do your risk assessment right, if the board says to me, hey, what does my risk profile look like? Your risk assessment say, oh, I was X, A minus. And then, you know, 3 months on, you've engaged in all these activities. You should be able to use that risk assessment approach and say, okay, I don't need to redo the whole thing because that's an annual process. I'll just focus on the new factors and then be able to run that result again and be able to, at a quarterly board meeting, say, last time we showed you that we had an A minus profile, but, you know, given all these activities, we new geographical footprint, new products, new customer types, so on and so forth, M&A, now we are being plus. Now the board should be able to say, I'm okay with that. Okay, then I won't ask you for more resources. But if you want to get back to that A-minus profile, this is what I need. To me, that is a very straightforward conversation everybody should be able to ask. Now, I could be seen as kind of simplistic, but I've had enough conversation at board levels to say, you couldn't even answer that question. Well, no wonder the board is saying, what am I spending this money for?
So, yeah, I mean, it's incumbent upon compliance to be able to persuade those higher up as well. And as to your point about you have to be an AML specialist and a technologist, I mean, we've seen a similar dynamic in law even, that there came a point where lawyers realized they couldn't just know about law, that they had to provide transactional value. They had to be a business advisor. They had to know about business and finance and be able to read a set of accounting statements. The broader point now that people are trying to impress upon a lot of young people is the fundamental question of the 21st century is that how well does your labor work with technology? Does your labor complement the outcome of technology, what technology produces? And if the answer is yes, you have a future. If not, well, you have an uncertain and perilous future. But I mean,
I think the question of what does that labor and how does it mean it turn out, I think it's a circular relationship, right? There are some roles in society that will always be labor. There's no way around it, right? The question is
brute force, man hours, dog, you know,
right.
Dog
work. I think it's about the, you know, country's approach, a jurisdictional approach to upskilling. I mean, as an example, we look at Singapore, right? The Skills Future Framework, brilliant. This was launched like 5 years ago. Really looking at what does my population need to get ready for the next century, right?
Well, as the founder said, to be relevant, right? We've got to be relevant to the world. Mm-hmm.
That's why our, you know, ACAM's role in education and you know, content upskilling, I mean, reflects. So there's a slide I was going to share that talk about, you know, when I started, we just had the CAMs. Now we have an entire training ecosystem, right? It starts out with like foundational knowledge, then the associate level certification, like the CKYCA, the CTMA, Certified Transaction Monitoring Associate, CAFCA, this is relating to fintech. And then even at the specialist level, we used to only have CAMS, and now we have CGSS, Certified Global Sanctions Specialist. And then the latest one is actually CCAS, which is relating to the crypto world. Right. And then layer on top of it is the advanced certification in risk management, in audit, and also in financial investigations. So it's like really holistic approach. And I think that's really the important understanding of whether you're ACAMS or a regulator or a regulated entity, you need to look at risk from a holistic point of view. Where are the risks in your entire ecosystem you have responsibility for? Right. And I think what money laundering prevention has led us to recognize how interconnected we all are, you know, money flows, you know. I mean, it used to be you were just thinking, I'm a customer, I go in, I put in my money, I come out. But money laundering actually asks us the question, well, how is that money coming in and how is that money going out and who is actually executing behind it and where is that money coming from?
To shift the focus a little, tell us a little bit about yourself. I mean, you're a Vietnamese ancestry. You attended Harvard. You had a long, illustrious career in financial services and banking. And so what was it about financial services and AML and compliance more generally that drew you in? I mean, why did you see that as a viable career choice, given all the other things you could have done after Harvard?
I would say that no one in our space actually thought of this as a career choice. I think we're all kind of passionate and mission-driven. And so I think of the world of financial compliance as what a better merging of you want to do something that, of course, take care of your family and all that, but make a difference in the world. I mean, that's what it is, right? What better way to spend? Everybody has the same 24 hours. How are you going to spend that 24 hours, right? And so I think what ties us all together in the AFC community is about the passion of doing the right thing, right? For me personally, obviously, I mentioned earlier one of the macro drivers was, you know, China, admission to the FATF, you know, the world economies and stuff. And then, you know, for me, it just made sense that I could be part of this journey. The truth is, I didn't know how long it was going to last, right? Because you can imagine 2008, there were very few open doors wanting to talk about AML. And even 2008, Hong Kong didn't, not that Hong Kong wasn't committed to money laundering prevention, but it didn't have its own law until April of 2012. And I was doing this four years, right? So AMLO was is as a law, not the commitment, but as a law, it's relatively young, right? In fact, one of the oldest AMLA, actually, you'd be surprised to hear this, was actually 1999 coming out of Thailand. But of course, it's all technical, right? So the question of effectiveness comes into play. But it, to me, this made sense. And I was a former regulator. And to your point, you know, I was an investment banker. I've done all sorts of things. So this to me was a convergence of all this experience and knowledge I'd accumulated. And it just sort of made sense because I was basically on a mission to try to change the way the world thinks about money, right? And as I said, money isn't just money. How you earn it does make a difference. And, you know, I mean, if you look at the latest our collaboration with the New Zealand FIU, I think it's our 12th or 13th year working together. And the theme this year, which is completed a couple of weeks ago, was that money laundering is not a victimless crime. And I want to point out to everyone, you know, there are 2-3 free certificates on, you know, illicit wildlife trade and human trafficking. But if you think about the work
that is the big one. Mm-hmm. And journalists who have covered that, mm-hmm. certainly for myself, having encountered it twice, when I wrote about it once for Thomson Reuters and when I was editor of Macau Business, that was my final issue, the human slave trade. I mean, you will learn things that mm-hmm. will leave a lasting impression. Yes. That will disturb
so,
you.
And that's the, yeah. that, you know, I find that believing what you're doing, the truth is we spend 80% of our waking hours working. To the extent that you can work towards something that, dare I say, makes the world a slightly better place, it makes sense to me.
In terms of the hot, topical, timely issues in AML and financial crime, what are the problems? What are the challenges that need to be addressed right now? What are the biggest problems institutions and countries in this region are dealing with?
Well, I think that the role of technology, that's a sort of pepper throughout our conversation, right? And what does it mean? You know, how do you upskill people, you know, the community, the professionals in this community to be able to, you know, not say, oh, I'm not a techie. To implement technology.
But most of them are not techies.
Exactly. But to implement technology without AML is not a good thing either. Right, because once, as I said, you know, 20 years ago, banks implemented this transaction monitoring system. It issued, you know, a million false alerts, and you can't say, "Oops, sorry, I want to restart that." The regulator's like, "No, now you're gonna have to go through all of them, right?" And you, there's so much wasted resource in that way. So I think it you know, it's incumbent on our job as an industry standard setting body to actually help to make sure that you're knowledgeable. Utilizing AML space to technology, right? So an example, of course, at the forefront of everybody in the last, I would say, less than a week is crypto, right? Virtual assets, right? And the risk they pose to our global financial system, given its speed, given its anonymity, given the irreversibility, right? And given that each, you know, crypto asset operates on its own blockchain, right? So then there's the question of interoperability. You know, how do you monitor? I mean, everybody says it's, you know, it's a blockchain, a distributed ledger, it's great. You can track every transaction. You cannot remove it. The problem is you actually don't know who the person who owns that key.
Precisely. Right? It's an incomplete, people don't get, it's an incomplete record. You can do point-to-point navigation. Mm-hmm. You can see where the money went to and from. Mm-hmm. You know the quantum of the transaction. Right. You can see the amount. But the party
behind it, yeah, is totally obscured, right? In fact, someone could have gone through a KYC CDD process, approach an exchange that I want to buy Bitcoin as an investment class. You do your KYC CDD, and they meet, they check all the boxes, and you get them board. But they could easily assign that key, and then that's it, right? And someone else could be using
the exchanges. Say, mm-hmm, we do conventional KYC, mm-hmm, before we onboard people. Mm-hmm. Because many of us are former bankers, mm-hmm, and we know the importance of this.
Yes, but it comes back to the basics of, you know, CDD versus KYC. There's a very interesting conversation about that. You know, to me, which comes first? Actually, CDD is what you do at the beginning. It's not KYC. You actually don't know your customer. You can only know your customer once you monitor their activities, associate accounts. So I think customer due diligence is, okay, you have these basic requirements you need to make sure you before you onboard the client and all of that. But you actually only know your customer once you match that profile to what they're actually doing, right?
Interesting point. So you only know them once you observe their transactional activity.
Yes. Because I just don't think it's possible for you really know a customer based on everything, because they know what you need to get on board. Right. They can carve themselves into a manner that makes them attractive. No one walks in the bank look like a money launderer. No one walks in the bank saying, I'm a criminal, right? So you do your due diligence. You make sure you cover it all. Now, the approach when it comes to crypto is whether, you know, your usual documentation, whether it's your ID, proof of address, all that stuff. Now, I think it also requires, additional CDD of what's your, social media footprint, right? So that's getting a little more complex, right? But at the end of the day, I really don't think you really know your customer until you actually match that profile. So
who was it? Someone pointed this out in the NACAMS event that, mm-hmm, that at that point, when they become a customer and they start banking with you, mm-hmm, at that point, the risk goes from speculative to actual. Mm-hmm. Because now they're a customer and they're using your financial infrastructure, mm-hmm, to conduct their activities, yeah, and now it's real. Now the threat is on. The game is on.
And so that's why I'm going to sound like such a broken record, but it's all going to be about risk assessment, right? The approach of assessing the effectiveness of your controls at the product level. It's not the customer, the product level, because the customer is going to do their thing, right? And you build a program, you look at where's the fundamental risk. So the inherent risk natures of crypto assets have to be really, delve into in depth and putting the controls. It's all about the controls, right? Whether the controls are based on your policy procedures or the controls are driven by your transaction monitoring parameters, right? But that's bottom line, right? Because to your point, they come in, right? You are less focused actually on the person than actually what they're interested in getting from you and why they want to be your customer, right? So it comes down to the product. I always have this very, very simple example. If you don't mind, I'm just going to go through it, right? Okay, so you offer a very simple product as a bank. It's a banking product. What's it for? Receipt of salary account. Okay, salary. Well, you only get exposure when the money flows come in, right? So you said, okay, well, what am I monitoring for? Okay, so what are the controls I'm going to place? Well, first of all, how often do you get paid? Well, in Asia, it's like once a month. In the U.S., it's twice a month. But if you put that kind of control and saying, oh, I'm going to allow, one or two transactions, you could blow up your transaction monitoring system. So you sat back and said, okay, wait a minute. Maybe we'll say once a week, and one transaction could be salary, the other is expense reimbursement. So that's 8. And you said, let's round it up to a nice 10. Okay, so great. That's a control. Secondly, where should that money be coming from? Well, you open that account in Hong Kong. You would at least expect them in Hong Kong, if not surrounding jurisdictions, right? Maybe even Asia Pacific, if you're generous, right? So that's the second control. So you're like, okay, I think I've controlled the basics. It's a low-risk product. Now you have, Wei Dang come in. You don't know who Wei Dang is. But what's your program going to address and risk rate Wei Dang? Well, you know the customer type she is. She is a consultant. Well, there's a whole list of agreed upon of high risk customer types, the industry. We work with the industry to come up with that list.
But consultant can mean anything, and therefore the income can come from anywhere. Well,
so that's the point, right? They're high risk. Why are they considered high risk? By definition, because they can travel anywhere, their income can come from anywhere. So the question is, you do your due diligence. You say, okay, how do I risk rate Wei Dang, given that she's using a low-risk product, but she's a high-risk customer type? Now, your system could automatically default and say, she's high-risk customer, right? She falls in that bucket. But 6 months on, a monitoring alert pops up, and it shows that, wait a minute, she pops up because she had 20 transactions the past month, right? Averaging the last, you know, 3-4 months. It's all not just from Hong Kong. She's not getting money from, you know, U.S. and Europe and all that. So what does that, should that trigger you to do? You always like, wait a minute, I go back to my due diligence phase. She did explain to us that we should expect about 20 and that we should be expecting payment from these because her job requires her to perform these functions. So at which point, now your risk appetite is a specific institution maybe, you know what, she's not a high-risk client. I'm going to downgrade her or lower her risk profile to a medium, and others might even say, you know, low risk, right? But that's a institution-specific risk appetite. Our job is to help you figure out where's the fundamental risk elements, right? And so this comes back to, you know, it's all about risk, right? How well do you understand your risk and what your risk appetite is?
So over the course of your profession, obviously technology has become more advanced, but how has AML, KYC, CTF, how has the profession changed?
The fundamental AML themes haven't changed, right? I mean, in terms of how do you know your customer?
Everything's a variation on a theme.
Exactly. You know your customer. I mean, how those themes rendered themselves has got more complex because of the role of technology, right? With e-banking, I mean, everyone keeps to think, oh, this virtual banking thing is new and scary. But actually, banks, you know, when they started offering ATM services, they started online banking, all of that. Actually, you've been doing some version of that over the years, over the last 50 years, right? And so I think it's all about stepping back and asking yourself, what's the underlying predicate crime that's driving my need to understand all of this, right? I think, you know, the pandemic has really sort of catapulted, I think, the need for, you know, customer onboarding remotely. But there's some very smart technology, right? You know, I was just recently onboarded for something, and they said, okay, I need you to show your passport. Can you move your face? Can you move the passport? You know, all the stuff. Now, that's great.
Is that good or is that invasive?
Well, I mean, it all depends on the bank's, you know, and the person's risk appetite, right? I mean, what it does beg the question, though, however, is that you do all these onboarding virtually and you have all these video, but is it searchable? What's all this database of video onboarding? How do you then convert that to usability? To me, that's an important question, right? You know, when you enter information as a database, there is data format and stuff that makes it all usable. But video-based, how do you convert that information you've gathered, that, you know, authentication process, into something that can be used by others?
So on the sanctions front, everyone's fixated on Russia right now. Mm-hmm. Iran seems to have taken a back seat. You're starting to see firms in Asia now, it seems they're more willing to deal with the Middle East, and therefore that might increase their Iran exposure. Mm-hmm. Certainly with firms here willing to deal with the UAE, which increases one's Iran exposure. And then, of course, there's Russia, and your thoughts on the current state of Russia sanctions and if and how they should be enhanced. Is there anything left to ratchet up?
Well, I must caveat all this. I'm not a sanctions specialist. You know, I have a colleague who does that. My view on sanctions really from sort of the broader FCC space. And what I would say is this.
Implementation.
The implementation piece of it is definitely challenging. And historically, we've always assumed that, you know, it is. There's a mandatory compliance element to sanctions. But actually, I think about 5 years ago, we started asking this question, is there a sort of risk-based approach to even sanctions, right? And I think the Russian sanctions boils down to, I kind of stepping back. I mean, I'm not an operator in the sanctions space, but I do ask this question, right? What is the driver behind a sanctions policy? And I think in the particular case with Russia has to do with the Ukrainian war. And the human element, I think, is what we need to think about when we think about the sanctions compliance, right? It's not just, oh, you know, some country is pushing their views. I think that has been the historical view about the use of the sanctions too as an economic policy. But I think in this particular case, there is a human element to it, right? I had a very interesting conversation. One of the presidents, I put it on my LinkedIn post, but a presidential advisor who actually came to speak at our European conference in June of this year, where we asked this question about, you know, Russian assets being that are held in Switzerland and how can they can be reappropriated to cover the, you know, the as reparations for the Ukrainian war, right? So sanctions have always been very challenging, but I think there's a fundamental human element to this that I think really does beg the question, why wouldn't institutions spend resources on it, right? This isn't just an economic policy. There are people behind the reason why, you know, they're being asked to look at sanctions.
Certainly in this context, it's a very emotive issue. And here in Hong Kong and Singapore, they're worried that Russian sanctions might affect firms in the region because I understand that under the Belt and Road Initiative, much cargo goes through rail, through China, into Russia, and in some cases through Russia to other parts of the Caucasus. And so that's worrying importers and exporters who might be caught up in customs sanctions, enforcement actions beyond their control. So, yeah, it's a tangled web. And, you know, these are human stories. People are just exporting their goods. But the sanctions... They're not discriminatory in one sense, and the law can be quite unforgiving to the uninitiated. And
that's one of the things I think, you know, I will point. We have these monthly sanctions update webinars that keeps everyone updated because it is such a dynamic environment that the situation is that if I were to say something today, it might not actually be validated, you know, in a couple of weeks, right? So I would highly recommend everyone to log into these webinars and then listen to the guidance, because you need to hear it from the practitioner themselves. We had a sanctions discussion, at our Hong Kong symposium. And the bottom line is, you're constantly on the hot seat, figuring out, what to do and then how to take a sort of a risk-based approach to compliance in the sanction space, right? Depending on your risk appetite, every FI is going to do their own thing, right? Yeah. But I think we can share some best practices, or at least, you know, sharings of any approach that can sort of mitigate that risk exposure.
So cryptocurrencies complicate compliance. I don't know if you saw Ken Ryjuk's piece on LinkedIn, but he said basically that in this day and age, what sane person would accept a compliance role at a crypto firm, given the liability issues that they'd be facing, as well as the fact that it's difficult to create, it's difficult to devise a sound compliance program for a crypto firm, precisely because of the nature of the underlying asset, going back to what you were saying, about the product. The product is fraught with peril and risk.
And also, there's also the consumer protection element of valuation, right? There is no, when you buy securities in the market, although there is market manipulation, but at least you know you're buying something that has an underlying value, right? The question is of, cryptocurrency is where is the value coming from and what does it tie to? And not to, embarrass any firm, but in the recent, bankruptcy filing of a certain firm, I think, leads to that question of, I read an interesting statistic where, you know, this particular crypto firm, you know, went from currently 104 legal entities, which is actually down from 137. So it kind of begs the question, where's the governance? Where are the controls, right?
Or is this intended to obfuscate, as a fact finder of fact might conclude?
Well, so I'm agnostic, right? I just ask the questions of effectiveness, right? Because to your question, how can I think I actually have a very dear friend who went into the virtual assets world very early on, very, very early on. And I said, you could bring the bank-like experience to this new industry. They could really use it, right? And he's done quite well, right? But to your point, it's sort of gone so big and so, it seems like everyone and their grandma has some sort of crypto exposure because they see this sort of rise in value, right? But I ask always this question. If it's too good to be true, it probably is, right? Now, those who believe in crypto assets would say, no, there's a very strong underlying value and stuff, but it just really does beg the fundamental question.
Where are these values coming from?
Exactly.
I mean,
who's the driver?
Who's the driver? And look, I got in early. Mm-hmm. I sold. I didn't make as much as I could have. Mm-hmm. But it was that constant valuation being in flux, mm-hmm, that got to me.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the three-sided pyramid, right? Mm-hmm. Is it a commodity? Is it a currency?
Mm-hmm.
Is it a payment system?
Mm-hmm.
And lately, it seems to be the first of those two faces, that people are engaging in speculation, mm-hmm, you know, currency speculation, commodity speculation. Don't get me wrong, I have seen people, and I've said this several times, people in Hong Kong, mm-hmm, people in other parts of the world, in India, in Dubai, who have gone from middle class, mm-hmm, to upper middle class and wealthy,
right,
because of this.
Yes.
Sometimes in life you get lucky. Mm. You might inherit property in Hong Kong. Mm. You haven't created wealth. Mm. You've just inherited a scarce resource. Mm. Mm. You know, that greed has really kicked in. And against that, I'm not sure regulators can do much. Therefore, is it compliance? Isn't it moot to talk about compliance in this setting?
I don't think so. I mean, it is, at its core, I think it can be seen as an alternative payment system, right? It does sort of...
The underlying technology does have,
yes,
its virtues.
Right. I mean, and that's actually is the reason why I started, when I saw this crypto stuff, I said that, you know, the governments could get into this kind of sort of virtual currency world by way of the CBDC, right? The central bank digital currency. Because it is tied to a fiat currency, and government will never give up control of their fiat currency, right?
Mm-hmm.
So CBDC is actually, I think, the government's response to this whole adoption of the value of or the use of virtual assets as a speedier payment mechanism, right? And so in that way, I think it really does, I think it creates some serious disintermediation of the traditional banks and correspondent banking, and all these wire fees you pay when you have to move money between, your various institutions, right? So I think that to me is the interplay that I'm more interested in. I think, you know, crypto will exist as an alternative asset class, and if you have the risk appetite for it, I think it was one of the first definition of an alternative asset class in the CFA. You know.
And the HKMA's position has been they're digital assets and you trade them at your own peril.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The intangible nature of it is what people struggle with, and again, it's rife for exploitation.
Definitely.
And yeah, but I mean the. People are cribbing mainly when they lose,
mm-hmm,
when they lose money. So again, and we've seen shades of this in Hong Kong,
yeah.
Lehman mini bonds. I mean, do people necessarily need to be protected?
Mm-hmm.
when it's their own greed for, you know, easy, fast money. But you've seen a lot over the course of your life in this profession. I mean, that it's always been heavily male dominated. Yes, there has been progress in the last 20, 25 years. Could you comment on that and any of the challenges you faced as a woman, and any advice you'd give any young female students out there wanting to?
I think senior leadership position in the AFC community is still somewhat imbalanced, but certainly the compliance world, yeah. I've seen more women than men, actually, right? Yes. I mean, if you look at, you know, the number, at any ACHEMS events, and you look at the audience, right? Now, there's an element of that audience being self-selected, but it's actually there are more women than there are men, in the field, right? And that is certainly the case that I saw in China, right? Many, many more women than men. And that's not an anecdotal observation. I think for me, it is an interesting question, right? As you say, I'm a Vietnamese descent, but I speak Cantonese. You know, I think what was very notable about Asia is that they're more focused on your educational pedigree than your gender or anything else. Right? And if you have the experience and knowledge, everything else goes out the window. They just want to hear what you have to share that they can learn from.
Certainly, yeah. I mean, I'd certainly choose Hong Kong over many places in this world. In that regard, it is more of a meritocracy than many people realize. And I'd like to impress that upon our students in both the corporate and financial law and the corporate compliance and regulation LLM programs. In the time we've got left, is there anything you'd like to say to them as they seek to chart out a path for themselves in this field?
I would say, you know,
join ACHEMS.
Well, I think being part of the community, whatever that form takes, right? Come in and, like, for example, I am going to ACHEMS Hong Kong chapter. Was actually established a month before Hong Kong anti-money laundering went into effect in March of 2012. So actually, we actually have our 10th anniversary sort of dinner gala scheduled for December 6th. So I would highly recommend come in and join and find out if you have. You can read a lot on our website, wonderful, all the resources, but you don't get a feel for the passion and commitment to this until you actually talk to the individuals, the people in it, right, the network. And I think you will find this to be a very worthwhile endeavor to go into this space.
Certainly, the mentoring and the contacts make a huge difference. In terms of the right type of education, I mean, is there a right path to choose to get into compliance? I mean,
I think it's at the end of the day, you know, you can come from different, you know. I mean, in 2013, actually, in Asia Pacific, we partnered with a Chinese university to launch a first bachelor degree in AML compliance. We did, yes. I think it lasted a couple years. But one of the things that is really critical, actually, it's not so much about your educational background as much as it is experience. Money laundering prevention, financial crime compliance, is all about operational experience. You need to know how a bank works. You need to know how a transaction goes through a bank. And actually, that's one of the things that, as I come back to our ecosystem approach, we're not actually developing some basic programs and courses in banking 101, right? You as a customer, you come in, you apply for an account, but what is actually happening behind the scene operationally, and how does that translate to, you know, money laundering prevention, money laundering controls, right? And I think that's really, you know, get your internship, be able to be part of the bank, learn how the bank works. I think that's a really great start.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is there anything else that you feel we didn't cover?
I don't think so. I mean, I think I just want to emphasize the importance. This is my mission for the next, you know, 5 years or so. It's going to be about the need for standardization, whatever that form takes. But my mission is limited resources, how do you answer the question? That's going to come down to risk. And I'm going to be talking about it for a long time, right? The need for everybody to coalesce around this standard so that you can all have the same language. I mean, the U.S. has been requiring banks to do risk assessment for 20 years, and yet you had the FinCEN ANPRM published in, I think it was September 2020, asking what constitutes a reasonably designed effective AML program. It, to me, begs the question, what, you don't want to know the answer to that?
By this point.
Yeah. By this point, right. So I think there's a need of standardization. And I am open to anyone wanting to reach out and ask for some insight or advice about what their career path can be.
We'll end it there. Wei Deng, thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity.
And thank you to our viewers and listeners. Until next time, take care.